Apostleship is a tough job. You know, the first reading, we have all this about, we hold this treasure in earthen vessels that the surpassing power may be of God and not from us. And that's true. And here's Paul describing himself now. We are afflicted in every way, but not constrained. Nothing stopping us. Perplexed, but not driven to despair. Persecuted, but not abandoned. Struck down, but not destroyed. Always carrying about in the body the dying of Jesus, so that the life of Jesus may also be manifested in our body. Often when I read that, I think of Mother Teresa. You know, at the end of her life, she was tiny, tiny, bent over, quite sick. I don't know whether you remember that the doctor who attended her in those days has visited us a couple of times. I haven't seen him now for years, but so that the life of Jesus may be made manifest in our body, in our whole life, the way we walk, the way we talk, where what we dress, what we eat, what we do with our money, what we do with our day, what we do with our free time. See, all of that should be manifesting Jesus. But that has to be then dying. Well, then the gospel. As far as we can tell, you see, the gospels were written, you know, putting down what was preached, what was said, what was told when the Christians got together very early. And there was a tradition about how you tell that. And so probably the first one to put it down in writing was Mark. And then he was followed by Matthew and Luke. Now, how much of Mark they knew and how much was just a strong, stable tradition is hard to know, and maybe we'll never know. But the point is that these all took place at the liturgy. The Gospels were formed by the way that these things were told at the liturgy. You know, we've spent a century or more working on Mark came first, and then Matthew copied Luke, Mark, and like they all set up nice with their computers. I mean, like, this was all done vocally, verbally, first. But there's a tradition that I'm trying to point out. After every prediction of the Passion, there's three in Matthew, Mark, and Luke. After every prediction of the Passion, there's a totally inept response on the part of the disciples. Why is that? Because they're so dumb? No, because we're so dumb. And we have to get it. So I'm going to read from you the setting of the gospel we have. Jesus was journeying toward Jerusalem, and on the way he took the 12 aside and said to them, "We are now going up to Jerusalem, and the Son of Man will be handed over to the chief priests and the scribes. They will condemn him to death and hand him over to the Gentiles to be mocked and flogged and crucified. And on the third day, he will be raised to life again." Now you'd think they'd say, "Lord, can we go with you? Can we help you? Can we defend you?" Well, you know, they don't. The response to these predictions is always something ridiculous. On the first time, our Lord predicts, and then they're walking back to Capernaum, and he says to them, "What were you talking about on the way?" And they say, "Well, we're trying to figure out who's the greatest." That's a great response to the prediction of the Passion, isn't it? Then the second time, that first time was rather when Peter said, "Oh, far be it from you, Lord." And he said, "Out of my way, Satan." He's not going to fool around with this. The second time, they were arguing about who was the greatest. And again, you see, well, the third time is the one we just heard about, as it's in Matthew. So after this third prediction, what happens? A Jewish mother, The mother of Zebedee's sons then approached him with her sons and bowed before him and begged a favor. "What is it you want?" asked Jesus. She replied, "Give orders that in your kingdom these two sons of mine may sit next to your right and your left hand." Jesus turned to the brothers and said, "You do not understand what you are asking." They know that he knows that they put their mom up to this, you see. "You do not understand what you are doing, what you are asking." In other words, every time the Lord brings up his passion, we duck it. It's a totally inept response. Now he asked them this, "Can you drink the chalice I'm going to drink?" "We can." "You shall indeed drink my chalice," he says. He knows they're not going to ultimately let him down, that when he gives them that grace to die for him, they're going to be there. Why do you think the gospel writers do that? I think because we often don't like to think about discipleship. That story ends, if you remember, you know, the Gentiles, because usually there's a teaching of Jesus after the prediction. See, the other 10, they were shocked. No, they weren't. They were indignant that these two guys are trying to get ahead of them. Why do the gospel writers tell us all this? So we don't get discouraged. You know, if the apostles were so stupid, then, and we're stupid, you know, but maybe we'll catch on yet, you know? So he called them all over, because they're just as mad, you see? And he says, "You know what? Among the Gentiles, the rulers lord it over their subjects, and the great make their authority felt. It shall not be so with you." That's an order. You see? That's why Pope Francis is trying to make sure there's no razzle-dazzle around the papacy, you see? He's called to martyrdom. He's called to serve the church in pain, you know. The weight of the whole church is something. But we just can't stand on the sidelines and cheer dear old Pope Francis along. We're disciples too. And so the Son of Man did not come to be served, but to serve, and to give his life as a ransom for many. Now, after all that, what did they put next? Life-giving. So they're still on their way. They're leaving Jericho now. They're going to start walking up the mountain to Jerusalem. And a blind man hears that's Jesus going by. So he calls out, "Jesus, Son of David, Ben David." Why does he call him Son of David? Messiah. "I will put on your throne someone who's your own son, your own body, and he will be my, you know, the king." The king, HaMashiach, the Messiah. So he's calling him Ben David, because he knows, you see? Or he hopes. "If I'm going to call you Ben David, and if you really are, please come and give me my sight." So Jesus stops. See, everybody's trying, shut up. This is a liturgical procession, and look what you're doing, you see? You're ruining it. Jesus says, "Stop this. Call him over." He says, "Well, what do you want me to do for you?" He said, "Lord," there were two of them in Matthew, I forgot that. Matthew doubles everything, I don't know why. "Open our eyes." Jesus was deeply moved that they asked him. And he touched their eyes. And that what? Two things happen. They recover their sight and they follow him. So it was, as with so many healing stories, it's also a vocation story. Do you remember Simon's mother-in-law? She was sick, remember, when they walked into the house there at Capernaum? And he went over there, Matthew especially, he sees her, he goes right over to her, and he raises her up, and what does she do? She serves him. She's a disciple. So we can think as we go through this liturgy now. We've all been healed. We've all been called. We've all been gotten out of God knows how many jams, how much mess we've been in. And so we serve. Now, in Matthew, she serves him. In Mark and Luke, she serves them. She serves everybody. Aren't the Gospels beautiful? Don't they teach us, help us? So on this feast day, we honor St. Matthew. At least we can say it. I'm going to at least serve during the day, and I hope get a chance to preach to somebody. Because the motive for preaching is compassion.